Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a great start so far this morning. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of our show today. I'm Rakah with you until 12:30 this afternoon. 10:07 is our time right now, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker is settling in to join us this hour for Science Files, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. We've got an open hour coming up for you next hour. It's our first open hour of the week. We call it Manic Monday, and as always, anything goes. After the news at noon, Halifax resident Joanne Roberts was named this morning the new deputy leader of the Federal Green Party, and she'll join me this afternoon. And historian Blair Beebe returns this afternoon with another Halifax history moment for us. But this hour, it's time for Science Files, brought to you by Meadow Ridge Estates, bungalow lifestyle living right here in Halifax. And joining me in the studio this morning to answer your science questions is St. Mary's University astrophysicist, Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning, good morning. How are you this fine day?
Yeah, it looks all right. A little chilly, but it's all right. It's
I'll
March.
Take the sun. Take the sun in 0 degrees over overcast and 2 or 3.
Yeah, and apparently another bit of a storm coming Wednesday, Thursday around there. So
what a shocker.
Hopefully that'll be the last winter's last kick at the can.
No, you can't say that, because we normally get that kind of dump at the beginning of April, don't we?
Yeah, we typically do, but at least we know then that spring is here.
Once we're through that, it's like, you can breathe again.
902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a comment or question for Dr. Rob here this morning, give us a call. There was an interesting study from the Space Agency in the U.S., NASA, involving astronaut identical twin brothers Mark and Scott Kelly. Scott spent a year up in the International Space Station, and when he returned to Earth, he was 2 inches taller, had less muscle than his identical twin. But it says here 7% of his DNA changed. You want to clarify something?
Yeah, so there's a whole lot of really interesting physiological changes that happen when you're in space. And let's start with the easy ones. Getting taller. That really does happen. Yeah, absolutely. And so if you leave your back in zero G for a long time, then it will literally stretch out. You stretch out just a little bit when you sleep at night as well. But as soon as you basically sit up, it's all gone. So
really?
And it's only a small change overnight. But if you spent several months in space, then you will literally, your spine will extend, and it's going to be tough when you come back down to the Earth. As I think a lot of people know, astronauts have a really hard time adjusting. Yeah. You've lost that muscle mass and so on.
Well, we see them when they get out of the capsule, when they land in Russia there, they've got to be carried out.
Oh, yeah. So Scott Kelly, the one thing that did amaze me is when he got off the plane and he walked down the stairs without any support. That was really pretty amazing, and I'm sure that was probably related to the fact that he'd been in space for such a long time before, so he knew what to expect. But anyway, the DNA, the story is the DNA. So this was really running on a lot of media outlets that suddenly his DNA was 7% different from his brother's, and like it was like, whoa, are we identical twins anymore? And actually, it's not quite right. What's really changed is what's called the gene expression. And so that is how all of your genetic information is turned into things like proteins and so on. And so that was measured to have changed at the 7% level. You can actually change that through not being in space. Like if you're under a lot of stress, you do things obviously that are bad for you, but even things like going scuba diving as well can change your gene expression as well if you do a lot of it in sort of like difficult situations. So those are things that will naturally happen to people. That's really part of sort of like being in a difficult environment for a long period of time. It's not, as far as I'm aware, necessarily related to the radiation load that you get when you're up in space, but I'm sure there's probably a little bit of a factor playing in there.
Now, this study obviously has an eye toward the long-term mission to Mars, which I believe would roughly take about 9 months to get.
9 months in a tin can.
So we're looking at about 18 months up in space. Though, let me ask you this. If they landed on Mars because of whatever gravity be on Mars, would there be some kind of return to...
Yeah, so Mars is about 40% the gravity of the Earth, and so you'll definitely have a feeling of your own weight when you're on Mars. There's going to be more gravity than there is on the Moon, for example. But you know what? This is really interesting because we really have absolutely zero data on long-term impacts of living in what I will call low-gravity environments rather than zero-gravity environments. Zero-gravity, we're getting more information on that. But low-gravity environments, we don't know a lot about. And this is like really interesting from a long-term survival perspective on Mars, because we don't know what type of potentially even diseases associated with being in low gravity, right? There could be, again, separate from zero gravity. Zero gravity we are studying. So this is really interesting, and there's going to be a lot of things that we discover once we, and I'm going to presume that eventually we do have colonies on Mars, whether it's Elon Musk or by some other method.
Wasn't Elon Musk talking about even next year or 2020, I think?
No, so, okay. Yeah. So he's talking about testing the BFR rocket.
Oh, all right.
Right. So that is actually way ahead of schedule, in my opinion, compared to what was probably expected. But they spent a lot of money buying an area of land in Texas outside Brownsville where they're going to be testing vertical takeoff and landing. So that is a big step for them. And so anyway, yes, but going to Mars and having colonies on Mars, we don't know really what human survivability is in those low gravity environments. So those are going to be big questions. Of course, lots of medical technology and development you can imagine doing if we do find there are problems. But there's a whole big area of discovery just waiting to happen there.
Yeah, do we have any, I mean, we've had astronauts that have been up in space for 6-8 months.
Yeah.
Do we know anything about long-term impacts?
Oh, yeah. So particularly bone density goes down over time. You can help a bit by doing lots of exercise. So people will probably remember Chris Hadfield talking about all of the exercise he was doing. That helps, but as far as we can tell, a lot of the things that happen in regular gravity, like impacts and so on, that are strengthening the bones, those are not happening quite as much in zero gravity. So even if you do exercise, you still lose some bone mass over time. You can keep up the muscles fairly well, although again, you're exercising different muscles. I mean, standing in regular gravity versus exercising in zero G are two quite different things. So that's something that we are aware of, but even so, zero gravity is not good for the body, let's put it that way.
10:14 is our time. Dr. Rob Thacker with me here on a Monday morning Science Files. And if you've got a comment or a question for us this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more with Dr. Rob right after this quick break. All righty, 10:17. You know where that music's from?
It's Jetsons,
that's
right?
That's the Jetsons.
That's great. Yes, well done, Katie. It's really good to have that back. Awesome
yes,
job.
Yes, indeed. Cambridge Analytica is involved in some big stories in the U.S. right now in regards to how it dealt with the Republicans and the last election, and whether it provided, the allegation is it provided private information from Facebook to some 50 million Americans to help the Republicans determine perhaps how they can get some votes. But they're now right now trying to stop London's Channel 4 News from airing an undercover report in which CEO talks, quote unquote, unguardedly about the data firm's practices to reporters who posed as potential clients. But this is a broader issue here, whole issue of mining for information, mining the human brain, basically.
Very much. I mean, I'm particularly... I want to talk more about this, but I'm not going to do it on this show. So.
All right, no problem.
This is a huge, huge issue. And one thing that we've actually talked about before, actually, is how technology is always so far ahead of how we can respond, both ethically, morally, and in terms of the law as well. So one of the key things in this is that Facebook is saying, well, you know, they said they were going to destroy the data.
Yeah.
Right? And they didn't.
And they didn't.
Right. Allegedly. So this is a huge issue. And I really don't have a good answer for how we keep in check all of these things that have the potential to seriously destabilize our democracy as it stands, without sort of like very close vetting of what individual firms are doing. And of course, for many, many reasons, we don't want the government to have sort of like peering inside what companies are doing at high levels. I mean, we don't want that. So,
but that's where we're headed, is it not?
It's super difficult to know what to do, because we want to live in a free society. But if people start doing bad things with data, then what are we going to do, right? This is a really, really difficult thing to handle. And so what's really concerning is that when you have enough computational power on the basis of really, really fine psychometric profiling of individuals, you can literally target messages on an individual basis. We are not ready for this as a society, right? This is a huge, huge issue. We are not ready for this. We don't know when we're being played, right? The best thing that you can do, as quoted by Chris Wiley, the person who's blown the whistle on Cambridge Analytica, is to be very skeptical of anything you get through social media and things like that. And I think that is a good way to look at social media in general. Edward Snowden piped in over the weekend and said what I think is an extremely insightful thing. And he said, well, if you look back to the Cold War period, companies that took data on lots of people were called surveillance companies. Now we have Facebook, we have Twitter and so on, where we are feeding all of this personal information into these machines and they are making money from that.
Mm.
That is something that we have to think about really carefully, because at the end of the day, what we've found potentially with Cambridge Analytica is even when people say they're doing the right thing, it doesn't take more than one or two steps for this kind of information to fall into the wrong hands and be used for nefarious purposes. Right. So this is a very, very serious issue for us as a society, I think, and something that is going to play out, it's certainly in the UK, over the next few days and weeks, I'm sure, with the legal side of things.
Very interesting. 10:21 is our time. Dan with an email question in regards to the Event Horizon Telescope. His question is a simple one. What's the latest?
So they're still analyzing data, as far as I'm aware. It was expected that it would take close to a year, I believe, to fully analyze things. That looks like it's going on a little bit longer. So I think that, if I remember correctly, they did the observing run last April. So we're pretty close to where we would like to be able to hear something. But I haven't heard any updates. But that doesn't mean there aren't some private talks going around there in the community. But I haven't heard them. So I don't have a good update, but it should be pretty close to having some new results from it.
Is this a listing post, or what exactly is the Event Horizon?
So the Event Horizon Telescope is a network of radio telescopes that use essentially the surface of the Earth to increase the size of the radio telescope itself, right? So it's almost covering most of the Earth's surface. So once you do that, you increase the resolution so you can literally see right up and resolve the event horizon of the black hole at the center of our galaxy, and potentially one other one as well. And so that is really amazing, because then you can start inferring what things are like just around the edge of the black hole. So really, really interesting stuff, looking at Einstein's theory of general relativity and so on. So that was a great idea. There's a lot of Canadian involvement in that as well. I believe some of the data processing is being done in Canada too for that. So really interesting, really amazing to be able to observe this kind of thing. But like I said, we're on tenterhooks waiting for some results.
Steve with an email question wondering, can we make use of artificial gravity? The current space station does not have a rotating habitat ring to combat the detrimental effects of no gravity on the human physique. Why is this, he wonders.
Yeah, so in actual fact, this is relatively straightforward to do. And I often find myself wondering why we haven't done this. I'm presuming it's likely related to engineering issues. Like if you have something that's rotating and you want to keep something central that isn't rotating, then you've got a bearing. And as anyone who's an engineer knows, bearings tend to break over time. So reliability, I mean, maybe we can engineer something reliable enough. You can literally just spin something, and he's right. You do get artificial gravity. This is something that was being talked about for a long time. Anyone who remembers 2001,
the movie, yeah,
will remember the space station, yeah, that you come into it when it was spinning around. So that is a very sensible idea. I'm pretty much wondering myself why we haven't done this. I mean, perhaps the argument is for comparatively small ships, you have to have very high spin rates to actually make this practical and have any serious kind of gravitational field from it. But at the end of the day, yes, this is something we've looked at, and certainly something that's been looked at in terms of Mars missions. And rather than spinning around the axis, if you just spin end over end, because what you need is a high spin rate, or you need something that's very long. So if you spin something that's very long, the speed at the edge is much higher than if it was shorter. Right. So it's the same as like if I go around at one revolution a minute,
yeah,
if I have a stick that's a mile long, the end of that's moving really quickly,
yeah,
versus if I have one that's only a foot long and I'm moving it at one revolution a minute as well.
But we don't have any, we're not designing any rocket ships that I'm aware of that include this rotating.
Not at the moment, no. So, but like I said, with something that goes to Mars, all you would have to do is literally just spin it end over end. You don't have to spin it around its axis. You can just twist it end over end. There was a CTV TV movie that used as many different sort of like scientific principles as they could. This was about 6 or 7 years ago now, I guess. And they showed that particular idea of like spinning end over end over end. I'm sure you probably feel a bit sick looking out the window after a while. But anyway, that's something we can practically do. But I'm kind of in the same boat. I'm not entirely sure why we aren't doing more of this, although I'm pretty convinced with the space station, it's down to engineering stresses and not building something that's tough enough for that at the moment.
Mark with an email question. Is the universe expanding at the speed of light? And if so, is its expansion increasing in speed? And also, he wonders, is the universe getting colder and colder?
Yes, to the last question. And so in terms of expanding the expansion speed, that's tricky because it depends where you're looking. But the harsh reality is it looks like we're going towards an expansion rate that's actually going to get faster and faster and faster. And there's no reason why the universe can't expand faster than the speed of light as well, because it's literally it's just space expanding. You can't send information. If you try and send light through that space and it's expanding faster than the speed of light, it means that things just really don't get where they're supposed to go, basically. So, nearby, obviously, it's not expanding. We're all fine. The studio is just fine. We're not expanding at really, really high speeds. But if you compare where we are to something way, 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 way over on the far side of the universe, that would appear to us to be expanding faster than the speed of light away from us.
10:26 is the time here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker is with me here. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. And if you've got a question for us this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We got about 2 minutes before our news break here. Let's talk about this big harpoon.
Oh, can we do the sunspots?
Sure. Oh, that's right. Yeah, okay, let's talk about sunspots. So, you got an email, Twitter question. Of course, now I can't find it here. Hang on, bear with me. Here it is. This is from Charlie, who wonders, if you have the time, he says, could you give us a rundown on the formation of sunspots?
Sure.
He says, I always find myself without an understandable explanation of these spots to people who stop and chat while I'm observing.
So this is a good question. It's kind of a tricky one. But I'll give the sort of like best explanation that I know of. And that's that this is all related to magnetic fields. And so you can think of the magnetic fields in the sun as kind of being like rubber bands stretched between the poles of the sun. But the sun is actually spinning around at different rates in different parts. So if you start twisting a whole bunch of rubber bands, you know they kind of get twisted up and messed about and so on. And so what's happening in the sun is this is all going on. All of the magnetic field lines are getting really, really twisted. And every now and again, some of the twisted parts will poke up through the surface of the sun. And that's what happens when you get a sunspot. The actual sort of like twisted magnetic field lines sort of like pop up through the surface of the sun. And the reason why they look cool is because all of that energy, that magnetic energy, is stopping heat coming in from around them, the so-called convection that keeps the sun similar temperatures in most places. The magnetic field strength is strong enough to actually stop that. So this particular region will then start cooling down, releasing its energy, and then it will look black to us. Hmm. Right? So that's how you get sunspots.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are those things that you see kind of coming off the sun kind of thing? Are those...
Right. So those are flares, and those are again related to the magnetic fields. In fact, so you can see actually the magnetic field lines being traced by all of the hot gas moving along those lines. That's one of the reasons why if you actually look at the surface of a sunspot, you can see these streaks going out from it. And those are the magnetic field lines and all of the charged particles in the sun. The sun is this incredible state of matter where all of the atoms have had their electrons that whiz around with negative charge pulled off them. And so you have all of these basically hot, well, it depends exactly where you're looking at on the sun. But anyway, so there are all of these charged particles moving around and following the magnetic field lines.
Very interesting. Yeah. 10:28 is our time right now. He is Dr. Rob Thacker, St. Mary's University astrophysicist. And this is Science Files here on a Monday morning. We're going to take a quick break for a news update and then more with Dr. Rob. We're back right after the news. 10:33 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker is with me for Science Files till 11. And if you've got a comment or a question for us, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, just like Rick's done here this morning. Hi, Rick.
Hey, good morning.
How you doing?
Dr. Rob.
Hi, Rick.
Question about the four states of matter. As I understand it, I think I was reading this the other day, that matter exists as solid, liquid, gas, and plasma. Is that correct?
I thought plasma was called... So you have salt... Yeah, okay, yep, that's right. Plasma is the fourth. Yep, absolutely. Okay. Go ahead, Rick.
The second part is... I was also reading that the sun ejects plasma.
Yep.
Okay. And in your knowledge, has there ever been a plasma ejection that has affected the Earth?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. So when all of these magnetic field lines are sort of all scrunched up around the surface of the sun, and if there's a sudden release of that energy and blowing everything out in what we call a solar flare, those will send out a pulse of this plasma at speeds around about 10% the speed of light in some cases, as far as I'm aware. So those will be ejected out into space at really incredible speeds, and those will head out towards the Earth. Now, all of that material is just going to travel on through space. I mean, there's not a whole lot. There's just a little bit of stuff in space, but not very much at all. It's pretty empty, pretty full of space. And so it will carry on going through, and then eventually it will start to interact with our own magnetic field. And of course, many of you who know, once we start talking about the magnetic field of the Earth, we're starting to talk about aurora. And so aurora, really big sort of light shows of aurora, are produced essentially when we have these big ejections of plasma from a flare at the sun traveling through space to the Earth and then interacting, going down all of the magnetic field lines that we have at both poles and then creating these beautiful displays that we see in the night sky.
Okay, and the third part is...
Oh, I've lost you.
No, you're here.
Okay, you there?
Yeah,
yep.
We hear you.
The third part is... The shift of the Earth's magnetic pole, I think that's happened in the past. Does that sound, you know, like...
Yeah, that's definitely happened in the past, yeah.
Okay. So during that switch, if we were, you know, does anything ever happen in terms of the weakening of the magnetic field against the sort of plasma and radiation from the sun?
Right.
When it switches, are we still covered, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, so I'm actually not sure what happens to the field strength during the switch. That is a really good question. My gut feeling is that because these magnetic fields are created by moving charges, if you go through a state where you're going from one direction to another, then there would have to be a lowering of the field strength at some point, making us more open to essentially cosmic radiation from many different ways, whether it's the sun or whether it's coming from other parts of the universe. But the flip side is we know from the geological record that although this has happened in the past, then it hasn't wiped out life on the planet. So that's been fine. I don't think there are too many things to worry about once it flips. It probably flips pretty quickly, so it's not too much of a big deal.
So I can stop digging the hole?
Definitely.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call, Rick.
Okay, bye.
All right, see ya. Max with a Twitter question. He says, Dr. Thacker, at the center of a sunspot, how much cooler is the sun's surface than the rest of the surface?
Oh, it's actually a few thousand degrees.
Really?
Right? Yeah, I think it's like 2,000 or 3,000 degrees cooler. Yeah.
Okay. We talked with you and others as well about the amount of junk that's up there in space.
Yep.
And I'm just reading here that Airbus is now testing what's referred to as basically a big harpoon to kind of snag some of this junk that's floating up there in space.
I wish I had one in the studio to aim at you. Just kidding. So this is quite interesting because as people are becoming more and more aware of the issue with space junk, it's incredibly sad that here we have this environment just above our planet and we're polluting that too.
I mean,
right? But here we go. So we have a number of defunct large satellites up there. The one that people are most concerned about is something called Envisat, which was an 8-ton Earth monitoring satellite that was run by the European Space Agency, and that just suddenly essentially stopped working in 2012. And so this is in a fairly important orbital area that we would like to use for other things, so we would really like to bring this thing down. The challenge is, as soon as these satellites essentially lose power and stop working, they tend to tumble. Right. And so it's not like you can use the Canada arm and just go up there and grab it and so on. This thing is like spinning around. And so using a harpoon is actually a really good way. You just got it. And so then you can literally reel it in. But even once you've reeled it in, this is the really important thing. It's still spinning.
Yeah.
So you reel it in and then you've got to use your own thrusters to take the spin off as well. So this is all physics. This like angular momentum. You can't get rid of that angular momentum without putting some energy in there using your own thrusters. So,
well, We've got a Japanese space station, I think, that's going to be crashing to Earth sometime in the next week and a bit, between the 29th and the 4th. It was the first Chinese space station.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if we had this Harpoon device, could that have snagged that?
So with Tiangong, we wouldn't worry too much because we know it's coming down. If we know things are coming down, then you can literally just leave it and it's going to come down.
But we don't know where it's coming down. That's the issue, I guess.
So this is a tricky thing. So the probability of anything coming down in a landing, a sort of like populated area, is close to 10,000 to 1. Right, so with 1,500 satellites, if you took every single satellite down, odds are you're probably not going to hit very many populated areas with any of them, basically. So there's a lot of, obviously, ocean covers 2/3 of the surface of the Earth and so on. So again, it's not something that people worry about too much, but there actually was an issue of a booster from a Chinese rocket coming back down and literally landing on a hillside just away from a village. And there's video of this happening, and all the people in the village go, oh my God, that could have landed. Yeah, absolutely be concerned about that. But they knew they're kind of in the target range for where this thing would be coming down, but there's nothing they can do about it.
Didn't Skylab come down back
in Western Australia?
Yeah.
So again, most of the surface of the Earth doesn't have people on it, right? But sooner or later, something is probably going to land in a populated area, whether we like it or not. That's just the likelihood of these things is increasing the more things that come down.
It is now 10:41 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker with me. And last week, the world lost a great man with the death of physicist Stephen Hawking, considered to be, you know, the smartest guy, I guess, in recent times. He's being compared with Einstein and these kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, I've said in a few interviews now that I think comparing him to Einstein is perhaps not fair. Einstein...
Personality-wise.
Einstein had a bigger influence over the whole of physics than Hawking ever could, because things have got so specialist in certain areas now, it would be impossible for Hawking to be as broad a physicist as Einstein was. You have to kind of go deep into one thing to make contributions now, whereas back 100 years ago when Einstein was working, you could have a knowledge of a lot of different areas and make impacts in lots of different areas.
Because the headline over this story is, why Stephen Hawking was so important to science.
Oh, absolutely.
Why?
So you can point to three particular things, I would say, in Stephen's career that really made a significant impact on the science of theoretical physics. But as well as that, obviously, the impact he had on the public sphere in terms of science communication, making people talk about science.
Bringing it to the layperson.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That is probably his... Well, I hesitate to say it, but I think that's probably his biggest legacy, like being known as a scientist. I don't want to use the term hero. I think that's a little bit of a cliche in this context. But being someone who was prepared to go out and inform people that you should look at the situation that you are in before you start deciding whether you can or can't make a contribution to something. So he was like, look at what you're doing, look at what your capabilities are, and then make an assessment of whether you can contribute. And he said, well, look, I may have ALS, but I still have my brain, and that's all I need to do my theoretical physics. And so that's why he said, well, sure, right? It's ALS is devastating for many people. In fact, he lived for so long. But for him, he was still able to do his work. And he actually is quite honest about the fact that he feels that suffering from ALS actually focused him to work more on his research. So anyway, the three things that stand out for me in terms of his science contributions. So in the 1960s, he worked with the famous mathematician Roger Penrose. Roger's written a number of books, a fascinating person in his own right as well. And they worked on basically Einstein's theory of relativity and how you can basically evolve into having black holes. It's not quite what it was, but that's a good enough description of it. And then in the 1970s, he develops this idea of connecting gravity and quantum mechanics together, these two really, really complicated theories. There's still no proper theory for doing that, but he came up with an approximate theory that said once you put the two of them together, then black holes actually start to evaporate and release radiation. A really fascinating result that people hadn't considered. And then in the 1980s, he worked with another physicist, Jim Hartle, on the beginning of the universe. And so he came up with something called the no boundary proposal for basically an analogy of what's happening with time at the beginning of the universe. Whether that's accurate, it's another debate altogether, but it certainly helped people think about what could possibly be going on. And so the famous analogy, I think I've even used this a couple of times on the show already, but he said, you can think, it may be that time is like the concept of north. Right, that north means something until you get to the North Pole, and then you can't say what's north of the North Pole. That doesn't make sense anymore. And so his analogy is that maybe time is like that, and when you get to the beginning of the universe, you can no longer say what's before this because it's lost its meaning. And so that's a really sort of like neat idea. Whether it's right or not is another matter altogether, but that helped us sort of like think about all of the beginnings of the universe in that particular context. So three really outstanding contributions. I mean, frankly, I'd be happy with one. Right? So I mean, amazing contributions there.
I'm reading here, it says, for Hawking, his searches were almost a religious quest. And he said finding a theory of everything would allow mankind to know the mind of God.
Yeah, so the theory of everything, I would say that is something that he didn't make as much progress on as he would have liked. This idea of producing the super force that brings together all of the forces of nature, could be string theory, could be M3, all of these things that Brian Greene writes books about. That's still going to take a few decades, in my opinion. The sort of line there, it's 21st century physics that requires 22nd century mathematics.
And he basically says here in 2010, Hawking admitted science may never be able to find, quote, the theory of everything.
That is a real possibility. I mean,
I want to hear more about some of what Hawking researched into, and I'm particularly intrigued by naked singularities and the possibility of an 11-dimensional universe. So ponder that for a moment. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back to hear more from Dr. Rob on Science Files right after this. $10.49, new Star Wars movie coming out, I believe, in December, if I'm not mistaken. Another one, the Han Solo story.
December?
Well, it's soon, maybe even sooner than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. This is young Han Solo, presumably.
Yeah, Han Solo. Yeah. Anyway, and apparently they've got a whole new series of Star Wars films coming up.
What a shocker.
Yeah, indeed. Patrick emails to say a final paper from Stephen Hawking was released that said to shed light on parallel universes and how we might detect them. Does Professor Thacker have any insight into
working sort of like a speed here. So I've actually sort of got the paper up, so I'm looking at it. And so this is related to something called eternal inflation, and I'll try and do my best to explain what that is. So eternal inflationary theory is this idea that at the very earliest moments of the universe, suddenly the universe expanded far faster than the speed of light and just suddenly got really huge, incredibly quickly. And so that solves a number of problems related to what we call fine-tuning, about how the universe basically didn't zip out of existence once it was created. And so eternal inflation is a way of basically producing a universe where you have suddenly this inflation goes off, you have a beautiful universe, and then basically some small part of that universe will suddenly break off into its own new sort of universe and then suddenly go through the inflation. And the idea here is this thing goes on and on and on eternally. And that's called eternal inflation. So his final paper is about eternal inflation. And so my guess, I'm sorry, I can't read a paper in 5 minutes over the break by Stephen Hawking anyway, but my guess is he's looking at whether there are any observable effects from this process that are filtering back into our own universe. My guess would be no. That's actually very difficult to do because a lot of the information that you want is probably destroyed during the inflationary epoch. But certainly something worth thinking about and worth investigating as well.
Interesting. Dan has a question for us this morning. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. First of all, I think that Rob Thacker could come up with a very interesting science fiction story if he wanted to write one.
I'm sure he probably could.
Sure. Yep.
But the question I have is, you see, in our own civilization, in our own culture, we admire technological progress, right? But when we study these, you know, pockets of civilization that get discovered every now and then, they're living in the Stone Age. The fact that they haven't changed, scientists admire that. And I'm wondering, is a maybe a more nuanced approach suitable? Because you could say that these places, these cultures are stuck. You know, the ones who are in the Stone Age, they've been living the same way for 1,000 years. So you could admire in one way, but you could also say that they're stuck in a way. Hello?
Is there a specific question?
Well, I'm just, do you have any thoughts on that? Because,
sure.
As outsiders, it's hard for us to evaluate. Maybe they're bored. Maybe they...
I think I know where you're going with this, and I think this is a very, very interesting question about what really is progress as a society. And so if you look at a number of, I will use the term less technologically advanced civilizations, because I think that's probably apt, then they tend to evolve towards a situation of equilibrium with their surroundings. And so they very quickly get into a situation where their populations fairly stabilize. Of course, they're often at risk to severe weather and things like that. But these civilizations evolve to a point where they're fairly imbalanced with their surroundings. What separates us is the capacity to utilize resources at an absolutely unprecedented rate in history. And so we are definitely not in equilibrium with our surroundings. Anyone who looks at how we're changing the climate becomes aware of that very quickly. And I think that this all speaks to the issue of sustainability at the end of the day. And are we really moving towards a more sustainable society? Because the answer is, if we don't, right, we're pretty much doomed. I'm not going to say we're going to make the Earth completely uninhabitable. I don't think that will happen. But what I do think is it will make the Earth that much more difficult to live on, that it's going to basically mean we have to reduce our population numbers to be sustainable. I think this is a fascinating question, to be honest, and a fascinating sort of like question of what is a stable society? What does that really mean? So, I think this is really interesting to talk about. It's not something I can give you a simple answer to either. It's a philosophical, it's ethical, and it's moral as well. So this is a very, very deep and difficult question.
Appreciate the call, Dan.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much. And it's hard to imagine that there are societies, and they're finding mostly, it seems, in the Amazon River area, the societies that have been, well, as he said, stuck in the Stone Ages forever, it seems, and contact with modern civilization.
So there are a number of now societies, and they find them every once in a while that have had very little contact.
But unfortunately, when there is contact, it oftentimes results in disaster.
Well, this is the
disease
unfortunate sort of reality of our history, that we have not yet come up with a way of interacting with less, again, I'll use the technology. I don't want to talk about primitive. I don't think that's the right word to use, but less technologically advanced civilizations. Usually the technological differences become a significant issue. And quite frankly, a lot of the time, societies unfortunately get assimilated in ways that don't keep whatever knowledge these societies may have that would be of great benefit to us.
Yes, indeed. Let's go to Joe on the phone here this morning. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Rick, how are you?
I'm well, sir. How are you today?
Pretty good. Dr. Rao, my question is quite simple. I just wondered if, speaking of Stephen Hawking, if it was ever established, if his IQ was ever established, or did we have any way of measuring his IQ?
I honestly have no idea whether Stephen ever did an IQ test or anything like that. I would tend to think he's got more important things to do, right?
He's a smart guy.
He's a smart guy, yeah. So the joke about intelligence tests and so on is, and sort of like societies like Mensa, is the old Groucho Marx things. I don't want to be a member of any society that would have me as a member. But I honestly, I really don't know. He was absolutely brilliant, but I have no idea whether he took an IQ test.
He was touted as being the world's smartest man. I don't know if there's any...
Yeah, I really don't think that's a sensible statement in any sense. Obviously, he was extremely smart, and whether he was the world's smartest man, I don't think... Smartest person, Rob, get it right, smartest person. And so I don't find a lot of value in sort of statements like that, to be honest.
Can we get another quick question in?
Be quick. We've got about a minute left here.
What's the difference, Rob, Dr. Rob, what is the difference in the functions of an astrophysicist and a theoretical physicist?
That's a good question. So really, the the difference between an astrophysicist versus a theoretical physicist, a theoretical physicist will work on things that aren't necessarily astro or astronomy related. So a theoretical physicist would often work on quantum mechanics and things like that. As an astrophysicist, they're the only place where quantum mechanics... No, that's not entirely true. I shouldn't say that. You would tend to not really work on the basics of quantum mechanics and so on. You would be much more focused with gravity and all of the atomic physics and essentially transmission of radiation. That's another big thing in astrophysics as well. It's just kind of slightly different spheres that you would work in.
Okay, thank you.
All right, no appreciate the call, Joe. Thank you. And Dr. Rob, the hour flies right by when you're having fun.
It really does. Wow, it's like time goes faster, not slower when I'm on here.
Well, listen, we appreciate you dropping by here this morning. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the week, sir.
Always a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University on Science Files here on a Monday morning. And, of course, Science Files brought to you by Meadow Ridge Estates, bungalow lifestyle living right here in Halifax. 2 minutes now before 11 o'clock, we're going to break for a news update. And then it's your turn to sound off here this morning. An open hour coming up after the news. We call it Manic Monday, and as always, anything goes, and our lines are open right now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take your calls after the news, and a news update is coming up next.